When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
And good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock, a few seconds after, but close enough. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, spoken word programming here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first and well into the second hour, another as yet aired event, this from September 20th, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Mystery at the Marriott. You'll hear a conversation between moderator Wayne Grady and authors Nita Prose and Kate Hilton, and also with their readings. This roughly 90-minute conversation and reading will run uninterrupted into and over halfway, obviously, into the second hour. In the time that remains following that in the second hour, you'll hear, I'll just share a bit of information about quickly approaching calls for submissions, deadlines, upcoming events, and I think I'm going to even include a couple of songs today. So that's what you can look forward to in the last approximately 30 minutes. A second announcement, not right now, is because I won't have a chance to work in my usual end-of-the-hour announcement about the blog space, so I'll just announce it now. I may repeat it halfway through the second hour, but just to give you a heads up, just a reminder that every week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. Those remain there for about 3 years, and I usually try to get it all uploaded by just before 7 p.m. or right at 7 p.m. after I get home from the show. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, in case you tuned in a minute or so late, I'm going to reintroduce what you're going to hear in this first 90 minutes or close to it, and then I'm also going to read the short synopsis that Kingston Writers Fest puts out a program guide every year, and so I'll just read. It's just a paragraph. So let's just do that. Again, in the first and well into the second hour, from a September 20th, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Mystery at the Marriott, you'll hear a conversation between a moderator, Wayne Grady, and authors Nita Prose and Kate Hilton. Also, you'll hear a couple of their readings as well. Again, this will air uninterrupted and over halfway into the second hour. And from the Kingston Writers Fest 2025 program guide, it says the title of the event again, Mystery at the Marriott. And what it says about it is witty, twisty, and best in murderous and highly contemporary cozies, Nita Prose's latest, The Maid's Secret, is a spirited heist caper and unexpected love story. Kate Hilton's and Elizabeth Renzetti's Widows and Orphans is a zingy whodunit, replete with suspect wellness gurus and devious influencers. Sounds like a nice way to lead into it. Here you go. It was a wonderful event, so here you go.
How many here are at Kingston Writers Fest for the first time? Ooh. And how many of you are happy we're here again? Good morning, and welcome to the Kingston Writers Fest. My name is Claire Grady-Smith. And as a member of the Kingston Writers Fest Festival Committee, I am very pleased to introduce event number 7, Mystery at the Marriott. Please note our land acknowledgement on the screen in the foyer. We honor the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples who lived here before us and still call it home, and we are grateful for the opportunity to share this space that is so rich in history, language, and storytelling. In a moment, I will introduce our moderator, but first a few words about the event itself. It will last for approximately an hour and a half, which includes a short Q&A at the end. Please come to the mic at the front center of aisle to ask your questions. If you have mobility concerns, raise your hand and an usher will come to you with the mic. I draw your attention to the Penn Canada empty chair here. As we gather to celebrate our freedom to write and to read, this vacant chair symbolizes the absence of a writer whose defense of these freedoms has led to their persecution and imprisonment. You'll find more information on Penn Canada's website. Kingston Writers Fest would like to thank the author patrons of this event. The Blurred Words Book Club, author patrons of Nita Prose, Mary and Kristen Glenn, author patrons of Kate Hilton, and Bob Montgomery, the author patron of Wayne Grady. We are also grateful to the City of Kingston Arts Fund, the Ontario Arts Council, the Canada Council for the Arts, as well as the many institutions, businesses, and individuals who support the festival, and the dedicated volunteers. We work long hours for the love of books. And now for the usual housekeeping details. Please mute your devices that might ring or beep. Someone always forgets to do this. Please refrain from taking pictures or recording the event. We have a festival photographer whose photographs will be posted on the Kingston Writers Fest website every day. Now it is my pleasure to introduce this morning's moderator, Wayne Grady. I have known Wayne Grady for quite some time. You could say I've known him all my life. My dad grew up in Windsor, Ontario, the child of racially mixed parents, which led eventually to his novels, Emancipation Day and Out from Freedom. Before that, he published 9 books of science and nature, including The Quiet Limit of the World, one of the first Canadian books on global climate change. His most recent novel is The Good Father. And he has a collection of short stories coming out next September. But Wayne is a polymath. His curiosity stretches far and wide. He is an award-winning translator of more than a dozen books, an essayist with a following of over 6,000 on Substack, where he accompanies his writerly essays with his own cartoons. And Wayne is also a closet writer of mysteries. 4 so far, set in Argentina during the Dirty War and featuring Detective Inspector Rodolfo Westman. Unpublished at the moment, but they should be. As Matt Cohen once said, if Wayne Grady's brain held a yard sale, he'd need a lot of sidewalk. Please join me in welcoming Wayne Grady.
Thank you, Claire. You brought me out of the closet. Maybe there are some publishers in the room. Welcome, and thank you for coming back to the festival. It's great to be back. And it's great to be here today, this morning, with these two wonderful writers. As Claire said, I've been dabbling in mystery writing, and I've been reading mysteries for a long time. And it's great to be able to talk to these guys who are terrific at it. I'm going to introduce them. As Claire said, we'll talk for until there's about 15 or 20 minutes left in the session, and then I'll turn the questions over to you, and there'll be a mic inside of the room. So I'm going to introduce Kate first, Kate Hilton. When Kate Hilton and Elizabeth Ranzetti became friends, they realized they shared a love of whodunits. During the pandemic, Kate recalls, Liz and I would gather together in a park to talk about how difficult it was to read and to write and how bleak it all seemed. And it turned out that one of the things we were doing to get through the long, dark days was reading mystery novels. Because, as we all know, nothing cheers a person up like reading a book. So they started to write a mystery novel together, which they eventually titled Burying the Lead, a newspaper term with a delicious double entendre. Their protagonist, Kate Conway, is a journalist who has returned to the cottage town of Port Ellis, leaving behind a bad divorce and her career in the big smoke. When she becomes a reporter at the local newspaper, she stumbles into one murder after another. I'm going to ask her about how many murders Port Ellis can sustain. Now, their second Quill and Packet mystery, Quill and Packet is the name of the newspaper in Port Ellis, Widows and Orphans, another journalism pun, they have thrown Kat into the midst of a hotel full of wellness wishers. Kate was already a published author when she and Anzetti teamed up. Her novel, The Hole in the Middle, which came out in 2015, was followed in 2020 by Better Luck Next Time, which Terry Follis called, quote, a witty, thoughtful, and layered tale of families, friends, and lovers, and the emotional landscape they all share. It's messy and wise, heartbreaking and heartwarming, and above all, utterly captivating. A full-time psychotherapist and life coach, Hilton has worn many hats over the years with careers in law, university administration, publishing, and psychology. Her advice to first-time writers is simple. Enjoy connecting with readers, savor every little triumph, and allow yourself to take in the compliments. Kate is going to give us a short sampling of her novel, and please welcome, join me in welcoming Kate Hilton. Sorry, I didn't prepare her for this. But,
No, well, that's okay. I like flying by the seat of my pants, actually. Let me just give you a... I'm coming at you sort of from the middle of the book, so just let me tell you a tiny bit, which is that Kat Conway, who's the amateur detective of this series, has gone to a local resort where there's a wellness, quote-unquote wellness conference, which is full of, you know, hucksters and peddlers of misinformation and so on. And she has quite a cynical eye that she's casting over all of this. Liz and I had a lot of fun creating some of the events at this wellness conference. So this particular event is called Skywards. And so they've gathered in the forest for this event at the conference. The drumming built to a crescendo and then stopped abruptly. Two young women emerged from the forest wearing the blank expressions of professional handmaidens. Clarity's minions. I recognized the one who'd brushed me off the first day of the conference. Behind them, a white-robed figure glided to the edge of the flames. Two elegant hands emerged from the deep pleats of the garment, grasping the edges of the hood and folding it back to reveal the glowing silver hair and sculpted features of Clarity Kay. Impressive, I murmured to Hannah. She's wearing a creativity cocoon, she whispered back. She told one of the vendors in the marketplace that they'd be available for purchase for Christmas. Clarity's acolytes moved through the audience with baskets, honoring each person with an individual sparkler. Once they had been distributed, the poet called for quiet. The drummers moved to the fire and lit a pair of torches. Spread out, Clarity told the group. Create a sacred circle around yourself and the fire will come to you. I chuckled to myself. It was as pretentious a health and safety warning as I'd ever heard. When it does, let your secret self guide your hand and send your message out to the universe. Hannah handed me her sparkler. It's all yours, she said. I've got an assignment. She slipped past me and I quickly lost sight of her in the trees. The drummers moved with care through the clearing, and as they passed, tiny explosions erupted. Streaks of light illuminated the clearing as dozens of hands etched their messages into the night air. The glade smelled of wood smoke and sulfur. I watched my sparkler flare and offered my own heartfelt wish to the sky. And then it was over. The crowd dispersed. Hannah reappeared, tapping busily on her phone. What are you doing? I asked her. You can create still images from the long exposure setting and then use an app to flip them so you can read them, she began, and then seeing my baffled face said, never mind, you'll see, give me a minute. She paused and then turned her phone toward me. The first image was a photograph of me with the words more and money floating across my chest like letters. I could feel myself blushing. You can delete that one, I said. She nodded and hit the trash icon. Here's Clarity K. Peace plus love sparkled in the air above her. Oh, that's complete bullshit, I said. We flipped to the hotel cleaner who'd written union in sprawling letters. Now for a couple of interesting ones. Here's Bodie Rubin's wife. Jenny Baker Rubin was standing alone, slightly apart from the crush of participants. Her message was more of a scrawl than the others, but it was still legible. I hate you. Oof, that's one angry woman, I said. And now for my last trick, said Hannah, and swiped across to the last image. It was Bree, and her skyward in full caps read, murder.
Murder most foul. Thank you. Nita Prose, continuing in with her best-selling maid novels, Nita Prose has brought Molly Gray back for the fourth book in the series. In The Maid's Secret, after her promotion to head maid and upcoming wedding to Juan Manuel, our heroine finds herself at the center of an art heist that will tie back to a forgotten diary written by her beloved grandmother. I hope I'm not giving too much.
That's it. That's all. Now you know everything I'm thinking.
You know all of this before you turn to page two. Oprah Daily has praised this latest edition, calling it, quote, a big-hearted examination of wealth and social class. The book that started it all, The Maid, was inspired by a chance encounter with a hotel maid in London. And I'm going to be asking you about that encounter a little later. But you've already said, the second I entered the room, Nita Pronovo, the former Simon & Schuster editor who transformed herself into Nita Prose in 2022, explained to Publishers Weekly, the maid jumped backward into a shadowy corner. It occurred to me in that moment that an intimate and invisible job, what an intimate and invisible job it is to be a roommate. Simply by cleaning my room every day, this maid knew so much more about me. But what did I know about her? British actress Florence Pugh is set to produce and star in a film adaptation of The Maid. Nita has been praised for creating Molly Gray as a character who, while not officially on the autistic spectrum, has many traits that point to neurotic neurodivergence.
Opposite.
You heard that before? Neurodivergence? Kate, you must know that. Her fierce sense of justice and egalitarianism, notes the Washington Post, a common autistic trait, makes her both a sympathetic character and a great mystery protagonist. We're going to talk a little bit about Molly's peculiarities and how they help her solve crimes. Please welcome to the podium for a short reading, Nita Prose.
Thank you, Wayne. Thank you for that. Thank you all for being here today. Thank you for coming back to this fantastic festival. I've been coming here a long time, let me just say, to this wonderful festival, and it's a pleasure to be back in a different way. The Maid's Secret. So you introduced it a little bit, and before I start to read, I'll tell you a little bit more. Molly Gray works at the Regency Grand Hotel. She is a bit of an unusual character, that is most certain. And this time, life's going really well for her, and her relationship with Juan Manuel, her beloved boyfriend slash fiance, is going wonderfully. She goes to the hotel one day. She's going to have a great event there because somebody is filming in the Grand Tea Room. And this is a show called Hidden Treasures, which looks a lot like the Antique Roadshow. Why does it look like the Antique Roadshow? Because I love the Antique Roadshow. And when you are in a room by yourself for a very long time writing every day, one must amuse oneself. And one must put Easter eggs that compel you to keep writing, and that's what I did. I also decided in this novel...
It's a pretty expensive Easter egg.
It is a very expensive Easter egg in this case. And so Molly brings in a few trinkets from her grandmother to be appraised during the show, and lo and behold, one of those trinkets turns out to be a Fabergé egg, the real thing indeed. And Molly, of course, does what any sane person, what I would do in that situation. She faints when she finds out it's worth $1 million. Or several million dollars. So that is how the novel opens. I decided in this case not to put another murder in the hotel, because as you were saying before, Wayne, how many murders can you have in one hotel before nobody is going to go there anymore? That's, yes, it's a very big problem. So we're lucky to be here at the Marriott, and so far, no one has done it.
Although, where's Bob Montgomery?
All right, well, I'm going to read from the prologue, and those of you who have read my books before know that, yes, mystery is one of the components, but the notion of the fairy tale is something very near and dear to me, and I've sort of included an ode to the fairy tale as my prologue for this book. Now I'm going to disappear, and I'm going to become Molly. My gran loved to tell stories. A maid for most of her life, her best tales featured maids. One of them went like this. Once upon a time, there was a maid who rued her lot in life. Her clothes were threadbare and worn. Her hands were chapped and dry. Why did she have to toil in servitude instead of living a life of leisure? Why was she fated to work from dawn to dusk for a paltry wage, cleaning a mansion she would never live in herself? She had no family of her own, for they had all forsaken her, but she did know love. Oh yes, she knew it well. There was someone who loved that maid deeply, and just one person's love is enough to keep your soul alive. Anything more than that is a blessing beyond all measure. And one day, while that maid was toiling in the mansion, the lady of the house asked her to clean out a wardrobe containing old footwear. There are work shoes left behind by a farmhand, slippers forgotten by a young belle, and granny boots that have seen better days, the lady explained. They're all cast-offs. They're worthless. The whole lot of them. For a moment, the maid wondered, was her ladyship referring to the shoes or to those who had worn them? Take any shoes you want, her ladyship offered. Get rid of the rest. Yes, ma'am, replied the maid. And she curtsied until her ladyship left the room. The maid then got to work cleaning out the wardrobe. Though the work boots were caked with dry muck, they were sturdy. She tried them on, and the moment she did, she was transported into the life of an orphan stable boy who'd once worked on the estate. She walked a mile in the boy's shoes, cleaning the barn and tending to the horses that provided the only warmth he'd ever known. At night, that boy curled up beside a mare on a bed of straw and wished for another life, to be someone else, anyone else other than who he was. And upon feeling the stable boy's keen loneliness, the maid kicked the boots off her feet. She was relieved to find herself delivered back to her own life as a maid. In the wardrobe was another pair of shoes that suited her better anyhow, the beautiful ballroom slippers that had once belonged to a belle. She fastened them to her feet, and as if by magic, she was wearing a gorgeous chiffon gown, being twirled around the dance floor by a dashing prince. But without warning, the prince cast her aside for a prettier belle, who he now kissed right in front of her. She wrestled with this clasp and ripped the slippers off. And delivered unto herself again, the maid eyed the last pair of shoes in the wardrobe. Old granny boots. She couldn't resist. She slipped them on and soon found herself living the life of a wealthy matron who'd once owned the entire estate. And much like a vampire, the matron derived pleasure only from sucking joy from those around her. She had no friends, no loved ones, and she pestered her workers ceaselessly, all for her own amusement. The maid removed those boots as fast as she could, relieved to return to her own life. That night she reported her strange experience to her beloved, who listened without judgment. When she was done speaking, he had but one question.
What did you learn? I learned that my life is not so bad after all, she replied. The maid was suddenly overwhelmed with gratitude. By walking a mile in each of those three pairs of shoes, she learned a lesson she held close to her heart for the rest of her days. That a life without love is not worth living.
Thank you. That was great. There's a kind of Dickensian feel to the way you read it.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
Great expectation. Kate, your co-author Elizabeth Renzetti is a journalist, and there's a lot of signs of journalism in both books. I love the titles.
Thank you.
I don't know if people who are unfamiliar with some of the terms of journalism, but bearing the lead is what magazine writers accuse newspaper writers of doing, which is like not starting saying there was a fire on Fifth Avenue last night, but leaving that until sort of like paragraph three and start out with like the history of Fifth Avenue. And it also is a great pun because it was another lead in the story.
Yes, yes. In that particular book, the lead of a local theater production, yes.
Yes, the lead
is our first victim, yes.
First of many.
Yes.
Widows and Orphans. When I started out as a magazine copy editor, and my first job was to kill widows.
Nice. Murderer.
Yeah, I know. Kill all the widows as a Shakespearean copy editor. And you're a psychologist and a psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist, yeah.
And how has your background come up in your novels? How has being a psychotherapist informed Kath Conley's character?
Yeah, such a good question. I had a I get questions sometimes where people ask, like, you know, you're a therapist. Do you think Kat is making a good decision here? What would you say if she came into your office? Like, well, I think I'd probably say to her, how do you think that decision is serving you? So, I mean,
how's that working for you?
Yeah, how's that working? How's that panning out? No, I'm very interested in the human psyche, and I have been through all of the different permutations of my career, and this is sort of the latest expression of that. But I think in terms of the specific way in which I bring that to these books, I care a lot about the relationships between the characters. So I'm really interested, as a psychotherapist, I'm really interested kind of in the relationality of the lives of my clients, right? Why are they, usually people come to therapy because the relationships aren't working, right? You know, they have specific issues of their own that they can identify, but it only really hits the road for them when they can't relate to someone they want to relate to, right? So I'm very interested in how that plays out in Kat's world. How does she, you know, we always have a B plot. It's kind of about a major relationship in her life, and Widows and Orphans, it's about a relationship with her mother. And of course, you know, as a therapist, that's a pretty rich territory, mother-daughter relationships. And a lot of times, you know, I'm not an analyst, so I'm not necessarily spending my time in, you know, family of origin, but it's inevitable that, you know, your relationship with your mom and dad is going to show up in the therapy room eventually, so that was some fun.
Tragedy and comedy is...
All of it, plus time, yeah.
And Nita, you were a well-known editor, a well-revered editor before becoming a writer. How did your working on other people's books help you to write yours?
It taught me everything I know. Everything I ever learned about writing is through the grace of authors, such as yourself. Wayne and I have worked together before.
She made my first novel work.
That's very kind. You know, I think it's because of all of those years of working with various writers and them allowing me to enter their worlds and help them solve narrative problems that I was able to, write a debut that had some scope. And without that, I don't think I would have been able to. So it's because of you, Wayne. Maybe not only you, because I did have a few other writers too.
Yeah, quite a few.
But yeah, that's why.
So I can see working on a novel as an editor would help teach you things like, or help you work on things like structure and you know, character. But the actual day-to-day writing, sitting down writing one sentence after another, that must have been new.
Well, yes and no, because publishing is such a deadline-driven industry. Every day you've got a list of 10 deadlines. You have to get copy done, you have to write a conference script. It's deadline, deadline, deadline. So that is a skill that I took with me from publishing.
Right.
I joke that it took me 20 years and 6 months to write my first novel, or it took me 6 months. Just depends on your point of view. I'm either the slowest author in the world or the fastest. I don't know. But
well, it took me 19 years until I met you.
That's true. It took you a little while, too. So we're both on the slow train to becoming writers.
Slow is good.
Slow is good. But, you know, it was all that preparation, all that learning from publishing that taught me to write quickly.
Right.
It's such a special relationship between the writer and the editor.
It is.
It's hard to explain unless you've been through the process. But it's such an, you know, and I collaborate with Liz, but that collaboration between the editor and the writer is really the thing that creates the book.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When it works.
When it works.
And it most often does, I think. You know, by the time you get to that level, it's great working with an editor who really understands the book and knows how to fix it.
Yes.
I understood the book, but I didn't know how to fix it. So that's great. And one of the things in both of your books, I think mystery novels, these books are not cozies. They're not just cozies. One of the things I like about mystery novels is that they're comments on contemporary society. You can read a mystery novel and see what things are important in a society at the time that book was written. And I wanted to ask you both about now, Kate, your book, you're pretty hard on the wellness industry. I think at one point you call it a late capitalist shell game.
Yeah.
Is this from personal experience? But it's one of the things, the monetization of wellness and of things that should be natural is part of the things that we're concerned about.
I mean, I think as a sort of an intellectual and also as a therapist, I have a particular loathing for this, monetization of people's misery, right? And
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Capitalism has done that in a variety of ways, but I find this one particularly insidious because there are real problems. For example, with medical misogyny, let's say, right? You know, there are lots of issues. Let's just take one example with menopause, okay, that are not well addressed by the present medical system, and most doctors aren't well trained in dealing with menopause, and so there's a whole demographic of women who feel underserved by the medical system. And what the wellness industry says is, you know, we're going to come into that space, we're going to not really care very much about the fact that you're suffering and you have these symptoms. We're going to just try to figure out the best way we can to make money off of that unhappiness. And I just ethically find that so unbelievably distasteful. And there are obviously like very prominent examples of people who are peddling, you know, jade eggs, peddling, like, you know, absolutely ludicrous, like medieval cures, right? For things that cause women genuine difficulty and suffering day in and day out. And, you have to understand that this is a multi-trillion dollar annual industry. And if someone's trying to sell you something, telling you that it's going to take all your symptoms away, you just have to try to bring some perspective to that to understand that someone is very interested in making money from you and not very interested in helping you, right? And so I, as a therapist, I'm like, you know, so many people come into my office with kind of misinformation that they're getting from social media and saying, like, I can't tell you how often I get asked, have you seen this? Do you follow this person? Have you seen this Instagram post? Like, do you think that this, you know, the reason that my relationships always fail is because, like, I have this particular attachment issue. And, like, you know, people take, like, the grain of an idea, right? And they turn it into a whole theory that they then monetize and sell people supplements and sell them, like, newsletters and videos. And, you know, it's so much of it. It's like there's a grain of something there, but so much of it is actually so totally unhelpful.
Right.
It prevents people from getting real help that they need.
Like,
yeah.
Gardening bleach for COVID, right? Now that guy's running the country anyway. You're also pretty hard on the convoy people in the book. I'm going to talk a bit about that. There's a whole, without giving too much away, Kate is trying to solve this mystery, and she's working for the newspaper, and there's this group of people who, how should I describe them? They're far right people who really want the newspapers to stop covering the things that they're trying to keep under the cover, and they become quite violent and quite
You know, so in a sense, I wish Liz were here, but this was a very passionate issue for her because so many of her colleagues have been threatened while practicing journalism while female and. She herself, writing about vaccine hesitancy, she just wouldn't believe her comments, right? Like, they're so violent, they're so unhinged, they're so scary. And, we were just in Minden last weekend speaking to a young female journalist, a real Kat Conway, who's running three papers in the Huntsville area. And she said, I read this book, and she said, you should know, we had a convoy at our newspaper office, and it just scared the bejesus out of us. They had a convoy. They had an anti-vaccine convoy at their newspaper office.
Right.
She said, I read this book, and I was, like, right back there. And it was so, so scary that these people just had, they were so upset that the newspaper was... in their minds, propagating vaccine propaganda that people should, according to the health ministry's advice, get their vaccines. And these people were so persuaded that these were like microchips and various other things, and they were making it very difficult to get into their office, and were really scaring the journalists. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this happened at newsrooms across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that mystery novels do, is set up conflicts that then hopefully get resolved.
Yeah.
And sometimes don't.
Sometimes don't.
Yeah. Nita, I'm interested in your first encounter with the maid. You write about sort of going into a hotel room in London, I think it was, and realizing and seeing there's a little essay at the end of this novel in which she talks about seeing him coming into her room, and a maid was sort of straightening her clothes, her jogging clothes, I think. And you realize that maid knew more about you than you knew about her, but she sort of receded into the background. How did that sort of translate into a novel in which a maid is the main character?
I don't know. Through a gift from the gods, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think every author gets a gift from the gods, and it's different for all of us. But for me, it came in the form of the voice. So after that strange little encounter with the maid, where we exchanged not even a word, I just became aware that this person who had been in my room so many times, knew what I wore, knew the medicines I took, knew if someone else had been in my bed or not. She knew everything about me. And somehow that little encounter stayed in my head. And a few days later, this was, as Wayne said, in London, a few days later I was on my plane ride home. And I started to hear a voice in my head, and it wasn't my own voice. It was that voice you heard before, which is keen and polished and very, very precise.
The Dickensian voice.
The Dickensian voice of Molly. And I was not planning to write a novel. That was not on my, sort of bucket list at the time. But in hearing that voice, it came to me really so profoundly, so sharply. I didn't have any paper. I did have a pen. I grabbed the napkin from under my drink on the plane, and I started to write what I was hearing. And what I wrote on that napkin, almost word for word, became the prologue for the first book, The Maid.
Mm.
And that's how it happened. It happened as some sort of cosmic accident, or at least it felt like that. That voice was delivered to me. It felt like from another place. And that was the catalyst of the novel to come.
Yeah. The road to Damascus.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's great. And I remember you saying earlier that for your research, you
I did bad
you
things.
You disguised
with...
yourself as a maid and went into a hotel.
Yeah, you know, when most authors talk about research, they talk about libraries. You know, they look up books, and that seems like a very sensible thing to do, and that is not what I did. My research was a different kind of research, and it had to be about being in the body of that character, about understanding what it felt like to be in a place and be invisible at the same time, which is what many hotel workers feel. They're there to serve, but they're also invisible, you know? And so what I did was I lurked in hotels, and I used to wear what is so often the uniform of many hotels, very nice black pants and a white, very pressed shirt, usually with a name tag, which I did not have. But I did this, and I went in hotels, and I just would walk around sort of watching various workers and maids and then imitating their body postures. And it's incredible how many doors you can open and how far you can get just by learning that posture of belonging and not belonging at the same time, of being there and not being there at the same time, of invisibility within a place. And what, you know, it's funny what you learn from those experiences in this kind of research. I remember one day walking on a floor of a hotel right after breakfast, and there are all these room service trays outside, and you know, there was little bits of food on all of them, and I suddenly realized with a real start that Molly, you know, in that first book, she's lost her Gran, who is, you know, the compass of her entire universe. She's living on a maid salary for the first time. She doesn't have the extra salary to live on. They are suffering food shortages like crazy before, and even now, her on her own, there's just nothing in the larder anymore. And Molly being Molly, she tries to ignore this, she tries to put a positive face on everything. But in actuality, there's a drone note in that first novel that she's kind of starving. She can't eat. She has nothing to eat. And she keeps fainting, and you know, it's exacerbating some of her other issues. And I imagined her walking down that hallway and seeing a little pot of jam and a discarded piece of toast and an apple, an untouched apple. And that she would have to change her worldview, you know, something that happens several times throughout that novel, because her hunger is so extreme that she would have to shift and think, this is not stealing, I'm not stealing that apple, that is waste not, want not, I will take it, I will eat it, because otherwise it will go in the garbage. And so this set off a course of thinking about who she was and how her world could be moderated by these changes in her moral compass.
It's just, yeah, because she's a very honest person, and
exceedingly.
Her first instinct would be, that's not her.
Don't touch it.
Yeah.
It's not hers, don't touch it.
But poverty and starvation changes the way one thinks about it.
Correct, and I wanted to embed that into the novel in a very seamless way, and that research helped me do that, and I did not get arrested.
Did you eat the apple?
I did not eat the apple.
You also had someone living in the hotel that no one knew, that the hotel didn't know about that, and I've often thought about that, you know, you say, in a big hotel like the Regency Grand, how long could someone sort of slip into empty rooms and not be caught?
Yes, well, this has always fascinated me, and I'm always looking in newspapers on stories about people who live in unusual places and are not found. There was someone, I think, in the U.S. who lived in a shopping mall for an extraordinary long time, like a year and a half before being discovered, and they sort of slipped between two walls and lived there. They actually lived there, and this fascinates me, and I think a hotel is, you know, somebody, it's this transient place where so many people come and go that you wouldn't quite notice if someone lived there.
Yeah, Pico Iyer lived in the LA airport for a year.
There you go, right.
Or a month or something, but he wrote a book about it. But yeah,
right.
Yeah, just no one knew he was there. So when I've talked to many writers who, mystery writers, who have, and each of them have a different approach to how they write a book. So I talked to one guy who wrote the last chapter first. He knew before he started writing chapter one what was going to happen in chapter whatever. And other people, they start writing and have no idea how, they don't even know who's going to be killed in the book. And certainly not, they don't know who's going to be the perp. How do you work? Do you map out each book before you start writing?
I do.
You do?
Yeah, I've always been a planner. I think I might be getting a little more relaxed about that, but not in this case of the Quill and Packet Mysteries because I write it with someone. Mm-hmm. So I have a co-writer, Liz Renzetti, who couldn't be with us today. She had another event in a different part of Ontario, so we split up for this weekend. But she... We rally, right? Like, she does chapter one, and she hits across the net, and I do chapter two. Mm-hmm. We need a really
watertight... chapter by chapter?
Yeah, really? Yeah, we do. But we really need a watertight outline to do that. Will modify it. We will go off-piste occasionally, but always... we're always texting each other when we're writing. But in a perfect world, what happens is, it's weird, Liz has always written the first chapter and I always write the last chapter. I don't know why it's worked out that way, but it has. And so the nice thing about that is that I'm also a real fan of Liz's work, and she says, and I like to believe she's a fan of mine, and so, a week will go by and I'll receive her chapter. It's very exciting, right? It's a new work by Liz Renzetti, and I'll see it, and I'll open it up, and I'll be...
His naked came the stranger.
Very excited by it. Yes, exactly. And then, I move to the next chapter in the outline, and I roughly know what's going to happen, but now I have kind of a little more color to work with, and so it's a nice iterative process. It's very collaborative and fun. But with these novels, I always know who did it. I always know what's happening at the end. Often, we'll add different layers into it as we're going. And certainly, there is room for getting excited about a particular character or relationship or adding some different nuance to the story. And then we'll modify the outline accordingly. But we basically know where we're driving to.
Yep. Right. But like you say, the middle can swell.
The middle is tough, yeah. I think, middle... I remember when I wrote my first book, a friend of mine who had been an agent for many years, she said, every writer has a problem. It's either the beginning, the middle, or the end. It's always the same problem. It's always the middle. I know how we start, and I know how to land a plane, but the middle is swampy in there.
Takeoff and landing are the hardest parts of flying, right?
Yeah, exactly.
The middle's fun.
You'll never persuade me that the middle is fun. I'm struggling there. There's like whacking things. Machete my way through the jungle. Yeah.
Nita, I'm just guessing, but I have a feeling that your novels are mapped out pretty thoroughly before you start writing.
It's strange because it's a little bit of both. I do plan, and I do know how the novel ends. And in fact, at the very beginning, I can see the seismic scene in each book. Certainly with the maid, there is a scene, I won't give it away in case somebody here has not read that first book. There's a scene near the end with Gran and Molly that is the big seismic scene that really defines their relationship in a lot of ways. I could have written that right after I wrote The Napkin on the Plane. I saw it so vividly, but some instinct in me knew I had to hold that back, that was going to be the reward for me getting through the messy middle. So I had to find all the rest of the things, the cast and the characters, the intrigues, how we would move on that arc all the way so that I could earn permission to write the scene I wanted so desperately to write. Mm-hmm. And that has served me well. Now that's what I do with every book. It provides a forward momentum. It's the reason to write. And I know how it's the climactic scene. It's not necessarily the ending, but it's the climax, the pinnacle of everything. I know I'm writing for that and to that.
Right.
How I'm going to get there, I have no earthly clue. And so it feels like stepping stones. Like there's this big ocean or this big river, and I only see a few stepping stones. And that's my planning.
I think that's a fairly common experience, I think.
But that there's this need to have a bit of gray area and this process of discovery every day.
But that's the creative white space. You need to have...
I need some of that.
Molly is a very, I forget what word is the psychologist was using, neurodivergent?
Neurodivergent.
She's very, very neuro, she's neurodivergent, and I have no idea what that means, but she's, but she's very, what that means in terms of her character is that she's very, she's very sort of strict and honest, and has a very clear sense of what's right and what's wrong. And that is something that really made me interested in the whole notion of justice. That when Molly has a very, don't give too much away, but at one point she wants to kiss Juan Manuel in the hotel, and then she remembers, oh wait a minute, there's a rule against staff members kissing each other in a hotel, so and so she goes up and asks the manager if it's okay to kiss him. And this is someone with a very overdeveloped sense of right and wrong, which is a good thing in a mystery novel, right? But one of the things that you said that Molly says in the second book is that justice as truth is subjective. And I was surprised that she would say that, because I would think that she would think the truth is absolute. I mean, this is true, and anything that contradicts that is not true. But she said she understands that truth is subjective, that my truth is not necessarily your truth, that what's true in the 1920s is not necessarily true in the 1950s, and possibly not true now. And then I thought, well, if truth is subjective and justice is based on truth, then justice must also be subjective.
Aha.
What is just to a society today is maybe different from what was just. I think we do have a kind of a sliding sense of what is, should the murderer be caught at the end?
Right.
And if the murderer is someone that we like, is a character that we've liked throughout the novel, do we really want that person to receive the full penalty of the law?
Right.
That's the kind of things that comes up in both of your books.
Yeah, absolutely. And justice was certainly a major theme in the entire series, but especially, I'd say, in the first book. I wanted to posit a world. Well, first of all, we live in a world where we don't get justice all the time. Have you noticed that?
Whoa, boy howdy.
Ooh. Ooh. And it gets harder and harder.
But we know what it is.
We know what it is, or we think subjectively, I know what it is, but Kate's version of justice might be slightly different than mine, and so on, and so on. And Molly understands that concept. I wanted to posit a world where this character would move through her life being the victim of so many different kinds of injustice, mm-hmm. and being mm-hmm. highly attuned to that.
Yeah. I love that about your books, actually.
Oh, thank you.
No, I think you do that incredibly well.
Thank you. Yeah. And I wanted her in the end to actually have a new kind of justice that wasn't according to the law, but where I would challenge the reader to think, she gets something. She gets something I didn't expect, but the way she got it.
So,
certainly dealing with justice in a new way and looking at it from a subjective point of view of somebody with a unique way of seeing the world was something that I was interested in.
Yeah, because it really throws her sense of her worldview around when she realizes what actually happened.
Right.
Okay, I'm talking about the first novel, but also in the second novel, in both of your novels, the woman who dies in your novel, in Widows and Orphans, is not necessarily one of the most lovable characters in the book, and the same thing with yours. And yet, justice must be done. Some justice must be served. I mean, I think the difference between a tragedy and a comedy. I think mystery novels are more comedy than tragedy. Tragedies start with a wedding and end with a funeral.
Yes.
And comedies start with a funeral and end with a wedding. And so if that is disrupted, then chaos ensues. I mean, the order is not restored. So how does order get restored at the end of your books, or does it matter?
I think in my case, this is the way in which it isn't cozy, right? Because it's a it is cozy adjacent. It's full of sort of political commentary and kind of sharp humor. But it is ultimately what makes it cozy. Is at the end of it, you have a sense in which right has been done. And you kind of can land in that sense of it.
But it's not necessarily legal, like court right.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, that's exactly right. Weirdly, I started my career as a lawyer, so I am kind of interested in that. And this is another thing I bring to the series. Like, Liz and I were working through a scene, we're just writing the third book, a scene in the end where, you know, Kat is defending herself against an aggressor, and I was like, you know, I think we've moved out of self-defense here, right? You know? Pull this back, like, actually, because we've got to stay somewhere in sort of the bounds of, you know, this is not a vigilante justice universe here. This is like, we've got to stay inside something that resembles kind of a formal legal structure, but it is a bit of a tricky thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are dead bodies landing on the ground, arguably too many for one small town. And so it's a funny relationship that you have as a cozy writer between sort of a sense of sort of emotional justice versus a sense of legal justice, and they can't be totally different, actually, right?
Yeah.
They have to kind of parallel play their way through the piece,
Because one person's emotional justice isn't necessarily the neighbor's emotional justice.
Well, right, and I mean, I don't think we have to look very far outside our borders to see what happens when, you know, we're being governed by a sense of one person's emotional justice,
right?
It's actually pretty freaky scary.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I get from both of your books. When that moral compass is disrupted, it gets scary.
Yeah, it does.
Because we no longer have, you know...
Well, it's not rule of law anymore, right? And rule of law...
Yeah, that's right.
The rule of
yeah.
law is something we can actually all depend on because it's predictable.
Yeah. I go back to the golden age of mystery writing when you know, Agatha Christie and Marjorie Allingham and Niall Marsh, they... Whatever happened in their books, it always ended with the rule of law being honored.
Yes.
Even if it was a sympathetic character who was turned out to be the murderer, that person got caught and punished.
Right.
I mean, a couple of exceptions to that, but that's no longer the case. You know, in mystery novels now, and some of them written by people in this room, it's not that the person isn't necessarily. Order is not necessarily restored at the end of the book. Order might be restored for one piece. There's a wedding at the end of this book. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. That's pretty obvious.
We knew it in the first one. But there's a wedding at the end, but that doesn't mean that all is right with the world, you know? How do you still call that a cozy?
I wonder that all the time.
Yeah.
And when people say my world is cozy, I'm like, really? Okay, so there's human trafficking, there's spousal abuse, there's a class situation which causes the very high to completely exploit workers.
And
this is cozy. Okay. But I find that interesting, and that was part of my challenge as a writer, was to embed, you know, these various layers of inequality and prejudice that we see in our own worlds, and to do so with a feeling that somehow it will offer some relief to the reader, instead of the headline news, which is placing a burden on all of us, and our backs are bending with the weight of injustice. So I wanted to posit a world where we could get so close to an individual character or set of characters that would remind us of the human heart, of the moral compass, of the good in the world that can actually uplift us and provide relief from the weight of that of the tragedy that is ongoing all around us.
Right. And you find your characters find that in love.
They find that in love and human connection, in belonging. Without that, they are lost. And that is how I give that to the readers, and the readers give it back to me, actually.
We're going to do that at the end of the session. and there's a, again, I'm hesitating to give away too much. And it's hard to talk about mystery novels without giving away anything. But there's a lot of interest in your novel. It's not between Kat and her mother. But it ends on a kind of a promise of something happening. And have you got the next book mapped out with that?
Yes, that comes back. I mean, one of the features that is cozy, I think, in both of our books is this idea that there is a village of characters around the protagonist, and you follow the development of those relationships.